Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello and welcome to The Rest is History. This is another chance to hear the episodes that we originally published in January 2022 about the role of the Vikings in the birth of Kiev and consequently Ukraine and Russia. Obviously, the question of what is Ukraine and what is Russia is massively relevant now in late February 2022 with Vladimir Putin apparently on the brink of invasion. Just a word of warning in this episode as well, there is a pretty graphic description of a Viking funeral that some listeners may find upsetting. It probably isn't an episode to listen to in the company of children. Thank you for listening. Hello, welcome to The Rest is History. We are recording this in early February 2022. At a time of escalating tensions in Eastern Europe, focused along the border of Russia with Ukraine. And Dominic, it's fascinating, isn't it, if you have any interest in early medieval history, because last summer, Vladimir Putin, or at least someone pretending to be Vladimir Putin, wrote an essay about the historical background to this.
5,000 words, Tom, I think it was.
5,000 words. And he went back, obviously, through the history of the Soviet Union, back through the emergence of the Russian Empire. But he ended up going all the way back to the 10th century and the emergence of the Kingdom of the Rus. Yeah. Russians, Ukrainians, and Belarusians, Vladimir Putin, I put that slightly in inverted commas, wrote, are all descendants of ancient Rus, which was the largest state in Europe. Slavic and other tribes across the vast territory were bound together by one language, economic ties, the rule of the princes of the Rurik dynasty, and after the baptism of the Rus, the Orthodox faith. And I guess two things leap out from that. One is Putin's argument that because there was this great empire, this great kingdom of the Rus, you know, covering a vast expanse of territory, therefore everybody who was lives in lands that constituted that kingdom properly should be part of Russia, I guess, is the kind of implicit argument. And the other argument is it's one from Silence, where he talks about Slavic and other tribes, but he notably does not mention anyone coming from Scandinavia, which is very much the sense that I have, that the foundations of the Rus kingdom, this kind of emergent kingdom in what becomes Russia and Ukraine, were actually Vikings.
Well, this is a massively controversial issue, isn't it, Tom? So this week's subject is the Vikings in the East, which is this impossibly kind of romantic, violent, exotic, exciting, murky subject, but it's also politically very controversial. So in the Soviet Union, there were massive arguments, and there was a sort of the real movement in the Soviet Union to say that basically, okay, there were some Scandinavians, i.e. Vikings there, but they weren't very important and their cultural imprint was soon kind of, you know,
buried
by Slavic traditions and Slavic culture. And we don't owe anything to these Scandinavians, yeah. Basically.
Yeah, so as I understand it, that argument first developed in the 18th century against the backdrop of Peter the Great's kind of defeat of the Swedes.
Yeah.
So obviously the Russians then didn't want to think that the foundation of their kingdom was Swedish. And then again, isn't it right that it was the Nazi invasion that really turbocharged this idea, because Hitler said that without the Norsemen going in, the Russians would be living like rabbits or something.
Exactly. So it's a sort of there's obviously a Germanic aspect to kind of Norse culture. They're very closely related. And so in the 20th century it became really important for Stalin to sort of say, no, we don't owe it. I think because the story is often told with kind of Viking overlords, as we'll go on to describe, Viking overlords, in inverted commas, civilizing the Slavic tribes. And obviously, if you are a very keen Slavophile, if you're a kind of Slav nationalist, That's very offensive, the idea that you needed to be civilized by kind of Vikings in horned helmets, which they obviously didn't wear, in their longboats and whatnot.
But of course, I mean, if you come from Britain, actually the perspective you have on the Vikings is that this civilizing process, by definition, I mean, is incredibly brutal. That acknowledging the influence that Vikings, you know, have on 9th, 10th century Europe, whether it's in Britain or whether it's in the lands of the Dnieper and the Volga, this isn't necessarily a civilizing process. It's a process of kind of conquest and brutalization. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the really interesting thing is that these two things are happening in parallel. So everybody when they think of the Vikings, I mean, basically pretty much every primary school in Britain, as far as I can tell, does the Vikings. At some point, kids dress up in Viking outfits and they put on horned helmets and they learn about dragon proud longboats and stuff. But they almost always study it in terms of a story that the Vikings first pitch up at Lindisfarne, they sack the monastery, and then they're constantly attacking England and France and Spain. And, you know, Alfred burns his cakes. There are a series of battles. The Vikings said, you know, it's all the West, and then expeditions to Greenland and Iceland. But actually, you know, a lot of Viking historians, Neil Price, for example, would say actually what the Vikings are doing in the West is a copy. They're copying what they've already started doing in the East. And it's the story in the East that is more exotic, more exciting, and also, crucially, I would say, more lucrative. There's so much money for a Viking to make sailing to the East rather than to the West. And you could argue that in the long run, couldn't you, Tom? Creating Russia is quite a big, big
and
thing.
And Ukraine.
and Ukraine. Right. Well, the issue of which of those can lay claim, it's a bit like the argument we had in the Alexander the Great podcast about Greece and Macedonia, and North Macedonia, as it's now called, fighting over the legacy of Alexander the Great, isn't it?
Yeah, because this stuff really matters.
Yeah, they both see themselves as the heirs of the Kievan Rus civilization.
Yeah, so we've the Vikings are such a great topic. I wrote about them in Millennium. I wrote about the Vikings in the East. You are writing a children's book about the Vikings right now, aren't you?
So
you're absolutely kind of immersed in this.
Yeah.
And it's such a great topic. And we've done one episode already on the Norse epics, which essentially took us from Iceland to Greenland to Vinland and the New World. But even in Iceland, they are writing epics about what the Vikings are getting up to.
That's
in
right.
The lands of the East, going down the rivers to Baghdad, the capital of the greatest empire on the face of the earth, to Miklagard, the golden city of Caesar, Constantinople. And as you say, it's a story that is very, very thrilling. Because you have the same, you know, obviously the idea of taking ship and discovering North America, I mean, that's an incredible story. But so also is the idea that people are going from Scandinavia and kind of pitching up in Baghdad, you know, or even further afield. I mean, it is an astonishingly romantic narrative.
Well, before we get into the sort of the narrative of it, I mean, the best example of that, and the one that most certainly British listeners, maybe English-speaking listeners will know, everybody knows the story of 1066, certainly in Britain they do, the Battle of Hastings, Harold and William. But obviously there's a battle before that against a guy called Harald Hardrada, who comes over from Norway to try and claim the English throne. And the life of Harald Hardrada is this whole business in microcosm.
Yeah.
You know, he had been in Norway, he ends up going to Kiev, he ends up going to Constantinople and commanding the Imperial Bodyguard. He may have gone to Sicily, he may have gone to the Holy Land, you know, this incredible
married a princess.
Well, these incredible adventures, many of which are unquestionably true because they're backed up in kind of, you know, Byzantine sources. So, I mean, you think about that life. He had a more interesting, well-traveled life than probably most of our listeners, certainly than us.
Yeah, definitely. Well, so we've got from Mary Kirk Alves, who asked very simply, why were the Vikings going east? Was it more of an expedition or a conquest? So obviously the geography of Scandinavia, kind of, you know, the ancients thought of it as an island. They didn't realize it was a peninsula. So you can take ship and go west across the North Sea or into the Baltic, up the Gulf of Finland. And beyond the Gulf of Finland lies the vast expanse, basically, of Eurasia. And the Vikings knew it as Sweden the Great, Sweden the Cold, a land of giants, of dwarves, of dragons, of men with mouths between their nipples who never spoke but only barked. So an intimidating place, but yeah, a place that, as it turns out, with incredible courage, with incredible fortitude, with incredible daring, can lead you to the richest lands on the face of the planet, the lands of the Caliphate and of the Byzantine Empire.
Yeah, that's right. And I think if you think about the geography, so if you live in Norway, if you live on, you know, one of the fjords or something, when you look out, you see the North Sea and beyond it, very rich kind of farmlands of England and the monasteries of Ireland and so on. And that's the way you go. But obviously, if you live in Sweden, you're looking out east, southeast. And the first thing you see is an island called Gotland. Where have you been to Gotland, Tom?
I have. Have you?
I have. I went there on holiday a couple of years ago. Absolutely amazing place. Beautiful island. Fantastic churches, where Rachel Morley would enjoy it. But also coin hoards. These incredible hoards of coins. Thousands and thousands of Arabic dirhams that have come up the rivers. So basically, what you would do if you were an entrepreneurial 8th century Swede, you would go to Gotland, and that's the sort of staging post where you maybe find people for your crew or you sign on with somebody. And then obviously the place to go from, I mean, you know, England or France, they're not really on your radar. What you do is you keep going across the Baltic. And there, as you say, you get the mouths of these rivers, and you know that somewhere at the end of that river is one of the richest cities on earth, Miklagard, Constantinople. And beyond it, it's all the wealth of the Caliphate. And you have, I think there are two things crucially that you have if you're Scandinavian that they will buy from you. One of them is furs, which you can kind of pick up on the way. And the other crucially is slaves. So this is a real, a massive slave trading enterprise.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And I think that, I mean, so how do you get there if you're if you're in Sweden? So there's Gotland, as you say, and there's this place called Birka, which is, I think just west of Stockholm now.
Been to Birka, Tom.
And it's as close to a town as you get in kind of early 9th century Scandinavia. And from these kind of centres, you can head eastwards up the Gulf of Finland. And there's the Volkhov River.
Yeah.
And there's a town, Staraja Ladoga.
Yeah, Staraya Ladoga, Tom.
Is that how you pronounce it?
Your Russian is shocking.
Yeah, okay. So
that's
this is a kind of, well, it's not Wild West, is it? It's Wild East.
Well, Neil Price has a lovely thing in his book, The Children of Ashen Elm, where he says it's basically Deadwood.
So, right.
You know, it's sort of saloons. But I think a couple of people, he's not the only person to have made that American analogy, because Tom Shippey in his book, Laughing Till I Die, about the Vikings, he has a nice section about how he says, you know, the way to answer Mary Kirk's question, it's not really like the kind of raids on Lindisfarne and stuff. He says the way to think about it is about trappers and traders in North America.
Yeah, with fur. I mean,
with fur,
the parallel is
exactly. Paddling down these rivers, and there are indigenous people, tribes on either side. Sometimes they'll trade with them. Sometimes they'll kind of fight each other. And and even the topography, you know, it's very heavily wooded, lots of rivers, lakes and things. So you start off in Staraya Ladoga and that's kind of expanding as time goes on. I think that's found in about 750, 753 or something. And then you go south, don't you? You pick your river and
Yes, because what the Vikings are bringing is the technology that enables them to navigate these rivers. And that's evident, I think, even in the name, right? I mean, there was a message from Tapani Simajoki, friend of the show, a Finn. And he says, an interesting tidbit on the linguistics of the East Vikings and Finland as the brackish meeting point of East and West. The Finnish Sweden, Ruotsi, is probably derived from the same root as Rus, Ruslagen. And Rus is rowing.
Yeah.
Lagen is kind of the band, isn't it? So the land of the rowers. And that idea of ships going down rivers, people rowing, often against the current, with the current. And the ships are sufficiently, you know, they're built so that they can negotiate quite shallow waters, and they're sufficiently light that, you know, you get to a lake, you need to go across to the head of a river, you can carry the ship.
Yeah, but that's where, also where the slaves come in very handy. So this constant issue of the portage, I think, is the technical yeah. term, where you basically, you get to the end of your bit of river, or you get to the point where you need to cross over, and basically you need to be able to get out, either semi-dismantle your ship, or the ship is light enough to for you to carry it.
Or your slaves to carry it.
Or your slaves. Well, this is where the slaves, basically your cargo, are carrying it for you. Yeah. I mean, that's the sort of genius, if you like, the sort of horrific genius of the business model. That you're trading human beings who are doing a lot of the work for you.
And so obviously there's incredibly, you know, you're very vulnerable if you're having to carry a ship, you know, up mountains and, you know, where the rapids are, or, you know, through forests or whatever. So you're very vulnerable. And so that's why along the length of these lakes, these rivers, at certain key points, you start to get more and more kind of forts, really. So Novgorod, yeah. I mean, you're the Russian speaker here, Dominic. That means new fort, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So that appears on Lake Ilmen.
That's right, and they called it Holmgard, I think, didn't they? The Rus themselves, the little fort, and it's sort of, I think a lot of these forts are kind of very North American style. They're kind of made of logs, aren't they?
So everything in Novgorod is made of wood.
Yeah,
everything, even the kind of, you know, rather than paper, they're writing on kind of bark and things.
Go back to Mary Kirk's question, is it a conquest? I don't think they think of it as a conquest, because they're not interested in, you know, it's not a risk where they're interested in kind of capturing lots of land. What they're interested in is the route, is the river, and making money. And yeah. they establish the forts as kind of trading stations, basically. And you can imagine the kind of, I think Neil Price in his book has a stuff about, you know, the scene, people drinking, probably lots of crime.
Tinkling on the piano.
sassy madams.
Sassy bar tarts. Yeah. All that kind of stuff.
Yeah, but that's the sort of atmosphere. And obviously that's quite cosmopolitan, in the sense that there are lots of these Scandinavians who are mostly, I think, Swedes, because that's obviously where you come from. But there are also, undoubtedly at this stage, lots of Slavs. So even at this stage, I think you've got the yeah. mix that becomes Russia, the mix of Scandinavian and Slav.
Yeah, absolutely. And so Novgorod is, it's a place, I mean, it's very like a kind of Western. So you get lots of celebrated figures in the Norse epics, you know, when they're down on their luck, they go there and they kind of recruit men, you know, people to go off to Britain, or, you know, attack Denmark or whatever. But at the same time, obviously from Novgorod, you can cross the lake and you can then either get the Dnieper, which will take you down to the Black Sea, and from the Black Sea to Constantinople, Miklagard, the great city, or to the Volga, which will take you to the Caspian Sea, and from the Caspian Sea to Baghdad, or to lands even kind of, you know, in Central Asia, the Silk Road, and so on.
They attack Azerbaijan at one point. Maybe we'll come to that later.
It's kind of incredible.
Incredible.
So Novgorod is the kind of, I guess, the meeting point of Scandinavia, Dnieper, and the Volga.
And if you're going the sort of the western route, as it were, the route down to Miklagard, the next stop is what becomes Smolensk. So, I mean, these are, you know, if you think of a lot of kind of well-known Western Russian towns and cities, they have routes along this kind of route, or indeed even further east along the Volga. So the Smolensk is a place called, seems to be begun as a place called Nezdovo, and that's the confluence of the Dnieper and the Svinets River. And again, you know, it's the same sort of Wild West kind of atmosphere, but it's like the tension is rising, because you're about to approach, as you keep going south, you're going to approach these rapids, these very exciting rapids
yes.
that bizarrely we know about from this incredible source. You must have
tons of stuff. A Byzantine like emperor, no less.
Yeah, who wrote a handbook.
Yes, for his son, Constantine the VII.
So he wrote
to the purple.
He wrote Porphyrogenitus. He writes a foreign policy guide for his son, Romanus. Basically, this is how you handle all our neighbors. I mean, just an incredible kind of almost like a policy document to have survived. And in it, he says, so, you know, the Rus, well, this is the deal with them. And he basically explains, sets out the whole of the route. So he says they have these special boats called, what are they called? Monoxala, single keel boats. So they're basically, he says at this point, they're in kind of disposable boats, kind of little kind of dugout canoes. They all go together in a big flotilla, he says. And by this point, you're in what is now Ukraine. So you're going down the river through the center of what's now Ukraine. And the river's only navigable in the summer. And basically, you keep having to get out. And as the rapids approach, the slaves will carry your boats for you. And the rapids all have excellent names. Do you know all the names of these rapids?
Yeah, they're terrifying, aren't they? And there's one of them appears on an inscription, actually, in Gotland, I think.
Does it? Mm. I didn't know that. One of them's called the Drinker. Esupi, the Drinker. Gelandri, the Yeller. Ifor, the Ever Fierce. Leanti, the Laugher. So on and so forth. So they're sort of these weird names for all these different rapids, and they navigate all them. But by the point at which they're coming down, they're coming close to what are more like states and kind of confederations of tribes.
Pechenegs.
So there's the Pechenegs.
They were terrifying.
They're kind of nomad. They've just vanished from history now, haven't they? I don't know. I mean, I think they became Tatars or something, but they...
But you wouldn't want to be caught by them.
They're nomads. Well, they will They'll cut your head off. And they will make it into a goblet, won't they? Don't they do that later? As we'll discover later in the show.
It's very, very Blood Meridian.
So they'll do that. And there's also the Khazars, who are incredibly interesting.
Yes, yes. So they are further east, and they're basically a kind of buffer between the Slavs and the Caliphate. So they're nomadic Turkic people, but they amazingly convert to Judaism, which is a distinctive thing to do.
Well, they're the world's only Jewish state, aren't they, between the Roman takeover of the Holy Land and the establishment of the State of Israel in the late 1940s, I mean, which is just an incredible thing to be. And why did they pick Judaism, Tom?
Well, the story is, and this again will turn up later when we talk about the conversion of Kiev to Christianity, the leader of the Khazars sends messages to all the various powers to send him a Christian monk, a Jewish rabbi, a Muslim scholar to go and persuade him. And it's the Jewish, it's the rabbi who wins out. And this was the subject of a fabulous novel, I think written in early 80s by a guy called Milorad Pavic, a Serbian novelist, called Dictionary of the Khazars, which is it's kind of a magical realist novel. Very good. I highly recommend it. And so the Khazars seem to, in a weird way, have become Jewish.
But it sort of makes sense, right? Because they're stuck between two rival powers.
Yeah, a Christian and a Muslim empire.
Yeah. So whichever way they jump, they're doomed. So they jump a third way, and it kind of works for them.
And I think that to begin with, it's the Caliphate that is really the focus of the energies of the Rus, rather than Byzantium, because it's an absolute peak. You know, we've got lots of questions about silver. So Stefan Jensen, himself a Viking, why are there such enormous amounts of Arabian silver coins in Viking graves across Scandinavia? It's the volume of silver that is really attracting them. And so to begin with, I think they're going down the Volga much more than they're going down towards the Black Sea. So they're going towards the Caspian. So they have to negotiate with the Khazars. And some of them definitely do seem to have ended up in Baghdad.
Well, they're drawn by the silver, but also by the slave markets, right? There's an inexhaustible demand for slaves in Baghdad.
Absolutely, yeah.
And, you know, obviously they are bringing slaves who are Slavs, but they also may well be bringing slaves that they've captured in some of their other raids further north. So there are lots of children's books. I mean, there's a wonderful book by Rosemary Sutcliffe called Blood Feud, where it's the story of a boy, I think it is, who is captured in Wessex. They take him to Dublin, to the great slave markets there, and he ends up, one way or another, he ends up going down the rivers and he ends up in Constantinople. But obviously he could have ended up in Baghdad. And, you know, it's not impossible by any means to think of quite a lot of, you know, substantial number of possibly Scandinavians themselves, English, Franks, Irish, Slavs going down all that way.
Well, I think it is mainly Slavs. And the evidence for that is obviously the fact that we have the word slave. I mean, it's absolutely imprinted on the English language and many other European languages as well. Have you read, come across Michael McCormick's book, Origins of the European Economy?
I haven't.
It's a really, it's a massive book. And his argument essentially is that the Caliphate in all, you know, so not just the Abbasid Caliphate, but the Muslim lands of North Africa and Spain as well, are so economically advanced ahead of Europe that all that Europe can provide really is slaves. And so the main provider of slaves is Otto the Great, for instance, friend of the show. So he is, you know, they are harvesting vast, vast numbers of Slavs, and they're being transported through Europe, down through Spain to North Africa. What the Vikings are doing is that they are going to the richest, you know, the heartland of the Islamic world, and going to Baghdad. And it's that opens up, you know, the vast kind of stream of silver that they're then able to bring back. Yeah. And it's really that explains the rhythms of Viking campaigns in the West as well, because it's when the silver mines in the Yemen and in Central Asia dry up that they then start to refocus their attention on England, which by this point also has a kind of very silver-based economy.
Yeah, and also because it's easier in some ways. I mean, if you can get silver flooding in, that's more immediate than getting land. I mean, land is great in England if you can get it. But you're right. I think we have to see the East and Western things sort of in parallel. That obviously, whenever that Eastern route is kind of cut off for some reason, or there's a diminution in the trade, then you see a kind of intensification of the sort of Western attacks. Yeah. But anyway, yeah.
Well, but it's just so you get that the Samanid emirs in Central Asia discover these vast silver mines. I think in kind of 890s. So. End of the 9th century. And over the first half of the 10th century, silver is flooding in from there. And that, of course, is the period where in the West, you know, the English state is able to construct itself, the fight back against the Vikings.
So Alfred and his successors.
Presumably because, actually, there's so much money to be made in the East that becomes the main focus of attention.
Yeah.
And then after about 965, the silver mines in the East dry up. And so Birka gets abandoned towards the end of the 10th century. And you start to get Vikings moving back towards England, Ethelred the Unready and Svein Forkbeard and so on. So I think it's really fascinating. I mean, we tend not to think of that, you know, the rhythms of the emergence of the English state and then the return of the Vikings to a degree is being conditioned by the availability of silver in the East.
Okay, we'll just take a quick break, Tom, and we'll come back after the ads.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
So So one last question on this issue of contacts with Baghdad, Tom. Diogo Morgado has an excellent question. Vikings and Arabs, clash of civilizations or trade-based contact? Did Islam have any influence in the decline of Norse polytheism? Well, I don't have an answer to the second half. The first half, I would say, not really a clash of civilizations. I mean, we have some really, really interesting things written by Arabs about the Norse and saying, you know, they're very dirty or they have weird customs and so on. Maybe we'll come to that. But I would say it's more trade, fascination, exchange and so on. But you'll have your own answer. What do you think?
Well, I think the question of whether visitors to the caliphate, you know, are influenced by Muslim, do some of them become Muslim? Do they bring Muslim brides back? I mean, the evidence. So there's the grave of a woman in Sweden was found who had a ring with kind of invocation of Allah.
Yes.
On the ring.
Yeah.
And various textiles have been found, again, with kind of Quranic phrases woven into it. The woman herself seems to have come from the Islamic world. Whether you, whether the fact that you have Quranic messages on your robes means that you've become a Muslim, I'm not sure about that.
So it's surely unlikely. Surely it's just high status, luxurious.
Well, because famously also there's a Buddha was found, wasn't it, in the grave. And that doesn't imply they're Buddhists. And they're a kind of the crozier from Ireland. They're basically kind of garnering loot. But I would have thought it wasn't beyond the bounds of possibility that the caliphs were kind of sending missionaries to try and convert at least some of these barbarians. That's what they were doing. So who knows? Who knows? It's a very kind of interesting question.
But Tom, that raises a really, really interesting set of stories. So we do know that there are lots of people who are, you know, Arabs and or Arab messengers, envoys and so on. Ibn Rushd, for example, Miskawaya. That I'm sure my Arabic's not quite that good. Ibn Kuradabhib. And apologies to listeners for Tom doesn't have the courage to do these fantastic Arabic voices, but I do. But the most famous one is Ibn Fadlan. So Ibn Fadlan this is the story that basically anyone who's interested in the Vikings in the East is familiar with. He is an envoy stroke missionary who is sent by the Abbasid Caliph al-Muqtadir to go to the Volga, to the people who live on the Volga, who are Turkic people called the Bulgars. So they're not the kind of Slav Bulgarians that we think of now. They're living on the Volga in what's now Tatarstan. And Ibn Fadlan has been sent there basically as a diplomat stroke missionary to build him a mosque. And when he gets there, he finds a load of Vikings.
Vikings.
And he's quite struck by them, isn't he? I mean, he's quite impressed by them. He says they're as tall as date palms, blonde and ruddy. And he's very impressed by their weapons and their kit and stuff.
But he's also, they are the filthiest of Allah's creatures. They do not wash after shitting or peeing, nor after sexual intercourse, and do not wash after eating. They are like wayward donkeys.
Yeah. So he sort of thinks of them in a very, you know, they're barbarians, basically, to him, aren't they? They are, in a kind of weird way, noble savages, I suppose. Impressive, tall, strong, self-confident and so on, but also weird and a bit unsettling. And he's obviously a really interesting guy because he's curious. So he says he hears that one of their chiefs has died.
Yeah.
And they're going to have this massive funeral. He's like, oh, can I come and... He makes the worst decision of his life.
No, it's an amazing decision.
He says, I'd like to come and watch.
Yes. In Baghdad, when the Vikings turn up, they pretend to be Christian, and they have to do that because if you're a follower of the book, then you can get in by paying a kind of tax. Whereas if you're a pagan, you can't. The thing that's interesting about this burial is that it's unapologetically pagan. You know, there's no pretense about it being Christian whatsoever. And the fascination of that for archaeologists is, you know, when they dig up the ship burials or whatever, and they find kind of various dismembered animals and the skeletons of women and things inside it. It's very difficult. You know, you've got the hardware, but you don't have the software. Ibn Fidlan's account provides the software that otherwise we simply wouldn't have.
Yeah. And also he provides quite good ammunition for people who say when these guys went east, they were still very much Scandinavians because this is a Scandinavian, an identifiable Scandinavian funeral ritual that is taking place, I mean, God knows how many hundreds of miles away on the Volga in what is now the absolute kind of Russian heartland. And he, how long does it take, Tom? Does it take 10 days, doesn't it? It takes 10 days to get ready for this funeral. I mean, it is the most colossal blowout, basically.
Presided over by a sinister old woman called the Angel of Death.
I saw she was a witch, thick-bodied and sinister. It's a Sibyl Fadlan. He's fattest, unfortunately.
And barbarianist.
Yeah, he's not impressed by the Angel of Death at all. I mean, frankly, with a name like that, you're asking for... disobliging commentary.
You wouldn't want, I think, to be a female slave in the vicinity of the Angel of Death, because
you wouldn't. That is for sure.
So someone has to accompany the dead Viking chief to the afterlife, and so they ask for a volunteer. And actually, interest doesn't have to be a woman. It could be a slave boy as well. But it's a girl who volunteers.
So they've lined them all up, haven't they? And there's people. So the guy's ship has been propped up on the shore with wood.
Yeah, his kind of half buried. Is that right?
I think something like that. Is it half buried?
So it's half kind of they've heaped earth over half of it, so that you then go in.
That's right. Yes,
but the other half is outside.
They've divvied up the dead guy's fortune three ways. So a third of it is spent on booze, unbelievably.
Which is great, isn't it?
A third of it is spent
like kind of death duties
on special kind of funeral gear, so on other funeral stuff like his burial clothes, and then the remaining third is split up among his heirs, basically. So there's this massive kind of festival atmosphere, and they get the slaves together and they say, which of you volunteers? And Ibn Fadlan watches, kind of fascinated. He's got an interpreter with him who's explaining what's going on, and this girl steps forward. She's teenager, I think it's pretty clear she's a teenager. Whether she is coerced or whether she steps forward voluntarily is unclear, I would say. Tom,
she having volunteered, she's then treated like a kind of princess, and she gets given slaves.
She has clothes and jewels,
and she gets given kind of drugs, I think,
for 10 days. For the 10 days of the build-up, she's expected to keep sleeping with the guy's pals.
And the guys who are raping her say, I'm doing this because I loved your master. So it seems,
very peculiar.
Very peculiar. And there's kind of weird thing where she goes to something that looks like a door frame.
That's on the last day, isn't it?
Yeah.
So on the last day, the 10th day, they set up a sort of a bed on the deck of the boat with this guy's, presumably by now,
in quite
putrid,
rank,
rotting corpse in bed, dressed in these fancy clothes, and they lay out a huge feast around his body. Then they bring out the girl. The girl by now has been, clearly she's been very heavily drugged and given booze and stuff. Then they bring a dog to the ship, and they cut the dog in half, and they throw both halves of the dog on board. I mean, it's so strange. They put all the guy's weapons in the cabin. They tear the heads off some chickens.
Yeah.
Ibn Fadlan at this point is thinking, God, this was a very bad decision.
But the
go
weird
and watch
bit,
this funeral.
The door frame.
Yeah, they lift her up.
They lift her up, and she says she can see her father and her mother. Then they lift her up again, and she sees all her family. And then the third time she says that she sees her master in the afterworld, and it's green, and it's beautiful, and there are all kinds of men.
Then they take off her jewels, and she walks onto the deck of the ship. But this is a weird detail. She walks on the raised palms, so she's being held up in a sort of, mosh pit style scenario by the men with whom she's previously had sex. So they all kind of, they hoist her onto the ship. She sings a leave-taking song, and then they make her drink two big kind of flasks of beer, I assume, or something. And then at this point, so Ibn Fadlan, at this point, his story, which is pretty dark, becomes genuinely very dark, because he says at this point she's confused and she's crying out and she doesn't want to carry on or whatever. But the Angel of Death at this point grabs her and sort of they drag her into a little cabin. At this point, everybody's outside drumming.
They're all beating on their shields.
Beating on their shields. It's such a terrible scene.
To drown out the screams.
Right.
That she's giving.
Then here's what's... If this isn't disturbing enough, apologies to... If you've got children listening, this is probably... why are they still listening? But they should definitely stop listening at this point, because they force her down on the bed next to the body of this guy. Then they all have set, rape her again. And then four of the men hold her down and two others strangle her while the angel of death is stabbing her with a knife. Evan Fadlana is watching all this. And one of the guys standing next to him says, God, you have terrible rituals in the caliphate, don't you? I mean, compared with this is brilliant. You must be absolutely... And you can sort of tell from his account that he's thinking, this is pretty awful.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really weird... I think it's so weird, isn't it? It's such a weird story. And it's sort of... you get this so much from Neil Price's books, that our image of kind of Viking religion is all very kind of jolly. And it's kind of Thor and his hammer and Odin and all this stuff. But this is the darkness.
I'm not sure about that. I mean, all the main gods are kind of terrifyingly phallic.
Yeah, but the way in which it's portrayed to children, Tom, and the way it's presented, Comics version of Norse mythology.
But Thor, I mean, Thor is a serial rapist. The hammer is obviously very phallic.
Yeah.
Odin is always raping. Frey, I mean, he has, you know, the statue of him at Uppsala in Sweden. He has an absolutely enormous phallus. It's unsettling, I think.
And this story is incredibly, I mean, it's unbelievably rich and interesting for historians, archaeologists, anthropologists, and so on, because it makes sense of a lot of the burials that you find. Yeah.
All those kind of dismembered corpses of animals and...
Yeah, exactly. And the weird things you find. But it gives you a sense of, you know, the sort of the jolly adventure story in Rosemary Sutcliffe kind of way in which so many of these Viking stories are told, actually misses out just how cruel and violent a world and strange and unsettling a world it was. Anyway.
Well, I think what I'm going to say now. That
it's about cricket.
The conversion of the Vikings to Christianity it removes them from a world that I think to us is unimaginably strange.
Yeah,
because we remain in the kind of the moral, ethical world that Christianity gave us. Islam as well. I mean, Ibn Fadlan's sense of kind of the sense of the strangeness and the horror of it is to that extent ours. And that world to us, I think, is very, very remote and difficult and strange and weird. And so the process by which the Rus end up becoming Christian is very, very kind of important. As that passage from Putin that I read at the start of this episode. Okay, well, I think that that's enough for today's episode. And clearly we thought we were going to get all this done in one episode. We're not. I think that tomorrow we should go to the Dnieper, we should go to the founding of Kiev, we should look at in a bit more detail the relationship of the Rus to Constantinople and the process by which the Kievan Rus became Christian. So we will see you back tomorrow.
Bye. Hello, welcome to The Rest is History. The story goes that in the year 860, the Chuds, the Slavs, the Krivichians, and the Ves, people who live in what we now know as Russia, had fallen out among themselves and needed somebody to rule them. So they turned to the Vikings. Our land is great and rich, they supposedly said, but there is no order in it. Come to rule and reign over us. And the person who accepted that offer was a man called Rurik, one of three brothers, Rurik, Sinias, and Truvor. Very close to Trevor, weirdly. Rurik.
you couldn't take a Viking chieftain seriously called Trevor.
Rurik established himself in a place which we now know as Novgorod, and his successors later moved to Kiev. And it's from that story that the countries of Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine all trace their history. Tom, we did the origins of the Vikings in the East yesterday. Do you think there's any truth to this story at all?
Well, I think the obvious parallel with this, if you are in Britain, is with the Dukes of Normandy, which likewise has a kind of almost mythic origin story. So it's Rollo who is given this land by the Frankish king, and all kinds of myths surround this figure. Yeah. I mean, he probably existed, but
he probably wasn't called Rollo, though, was he?
No.
Tom Shippey, in his book about the Vikings, calls him Ganga Rolf, which I think is a much better name.
Yes. And all kinds of, and so there are all kinds of stories about how he founds Normandy and about how the original Normans are not just Vikings, but they're people from, you know, all kinds of different backgrounds. And he establishes this, this duchy, and, the question of whether, you know, William the Conqueror, the most famous of the Dukes of Normandy, is he a Viking? Is he French? You know, what is he exactly? I think that that sheds a kind of really interesting light on the process of state formation in Novgorod, but even more particularly in Kiev.
Yeah.
And obviously the background to this, as in the West, so in the East, it's about the way that the Vikings are moving into strange lands, establishing Viking polities that nevertheless take on the lineaments of the lands and the cultures and the peoples that they're settling among.
Well, that's a very controversial subject though, isn't it? Because how much that's the case is kind of has been bitterly contested by academics. How Viking are they? For those people who didn't listen to yesterday, I can't believe there's anybody who didn't listen to yesterday's podcast, but we did sort of first 100 years. So the Vikings have been what we, I mean, Vikings is actually the wrong word because they're not really.
The Rus.
Yeah, the raiding, the Rus, as they
the rowers,
have been coming largely from Sweden down the rivers from the Baltic and establishing this trading network, which is going to start to take on, as Tom said, it's not just the lineaments of the culture around it, but the lineaments of a state. And how yeah. quickly it does that is again debatable. So the sort of origin story that's told is that which is very flattering, by the way, to the Scandinavian self-esteem. You could say it's a kind of slightly colonial story, is that the surrounding peoples are so shambolic and kind of disorganized and backward, they are falling out among themselves, and they have to ask the Vikings, the Rus, to come in and rule them. And there might be some element of truth in that, don't you think, Tom, that they might, you know, appeal to these armed guys in their trading posts to come and help them against a rival clan or a rival tribe, and that's how it starts, do you think?
Well, I think it's failing the kind of the brute process by which I think pretty clearly what happens is that you as we said in the early episode, you know, these to begin with are trading ventures, and so you have to have transit posts, you have to have places where you can not just do deals, not just store things ready for when the rivers become navigable, but also to kind of pick up information. You know, you can't survive without that. And we drew the parallel yesterday with trading posts in, say, Canada in the 18th century. But it's pretty clear that before long, these transit posts become forts.
Yeah, wooden forts. Basically.
And once they've become forts, then you can do what the Vikings are doing in the West as well, which is basically to kind of set up protection rackets. So what's been a cartel becomes a kind of mafia-style operation.
Yeah.
And you're charging protection money. And if Rurik existed, and there is a kind of historically attested Rurik at around this time, I think, attested in Scandinavia. But
yeah, that's right.
Whether it's the same
in
person
Sweden,
or not is debated. But if he existed, I think you could imagine him as the kind of the equivalent of a mafia boss. And then... you know, again, as happens in the West, Normandy being the obvious example, a kind of a protection racket becomes a state.
Well, so we know so little about Rurik. We know that he established himself in Novgorod, which we talked about yesterday, and there's a statue of him to this day.
And this is the second half of the 9th century.
Yeah, this is was 860, I think it is. Is it? Yeah, about 860 to 862 are the dates given. And so, by the way, we haven't really talked about sources. This is coming from an incredible source called the Russian Primary Chronicle, which is, as is so often the way, written
in the 12th century.
Yeah, exactly. Written at least 300 years later, by a monk called Nestor, I think, and you know is written in very different kind of political and cultural circumstances. So we, as with so much of early medieval history, we just don't know whether these are legends, whether there's a grain of truth in them, whether it's retrospective kind of legitimizing.
I think there must be a grain of truth because I think that the idea of a kind of dynastic descent from Rurik becomes quite important. So, you know, if Rurik didn't exist, someone of the same name must have.
But yeah, well, someone of the same, but the whole thing, Rurik and two brothers. I mean, maybe that not the kind two brothers. All that sort of stuff.
But there's clearly a dynasty establishes itself in Novgorod.
Yeah.
That will then expand.
Yeah, so there's two guys who are, it says in the Russian Primary Chronicle, two men who do not belong to Rurik's kin, but were boyars. That's the kind of Russian. They're basically captains. I don't know what the word is. They're not nobles. I mean, nobles is the wrong word, but they're sort of, they're members of the gang, would you say?
Soldiers, yeah. I guess, is what Mafia knows. Yeah.
And they basically go off. They're called, in the Russian Primary Chronicle has them as Askold and Deer. And as with so many of these names, almost all the names we're talking about, they're Slavicized versions of originally Norse names, aren't they? Because I think they were Huskulda and Duri, the original, my beautiful,
yeah,
absolutely impeccable Norse. Old Norse pronunciation there, Tom, I hope you noticed. They go off down the Dnieper and they come to what the chronicle says is a city on a hill. Again, a little bit too kind of folktale stroke biblical, I think. But anyway, this place is Kiev and it already exists. Been set up by somebody called Key, hence the
and
name.
Ev.
Yeah. And Askold and Deer supposedly settle in Kiev and say this is a great place. I mean, obviously it's a good place because it's further down the river, or further towards Constantinople. So it kind of makes sense that they've established another fort stroke trading station that becomes their own little polity.
And so the question of whether Kiev is Viking, which, you know, Putin's been worrying about this, so it's a topical question. But again, would you think that maybe, you know, there'd be a parallel perhaps with York?
Jorvik.
You know, it's a pre-existing settlement, gets taken over by the Vikings, gets a Viking name, the Vikings rule it, and then they gradually get absorbed into the fabric of what, you know, returns to being an English city. That perhaps there's, the parallels are never exact, but there's something there.
Yeah.
Of what's happening in the East as well as the West.
Your parallel with Normandy was a really good one. I think to people at the time, sort of 9th, 10th century people, our attempts to fix labels on them would seem weird, wouldn't they? They would say, well, who cares? I mean, what's it to you? What ethnicity? The concept wouldn't make an enormous amount of sense to them. So the question of, you know, are they Slavs? Are they Scandinavian? Are they Russians, Ukrainians? I mean, in a sense, it's a very, very anachronistic question. I mean, what matters to them is who's got the weapons, the power, the money.
What they are is lads.
Yeah.
Absolute lads.
And they are, but I don't think they're the Bullingdon lads, Tom. I think
they're much more predatory and brutal. Because Askold and Deer, they're these pair of kind of Viking adventurers, the kin of Rurik, his descent, you know, his heirs, if they exist, they're moving in.
Yeah.
And they're like the kind of, you know, the bigger crime family moving in, and they take over Kiev, and Kiev opens up the access to the Black Sea, and beyond the Black Sea lies Miklagard, Constantinople.
Yeah, which we haven't talked about at all, which is enjoying it's a renaissance, isn't it? Are we not in the Macedonian Renaissance at this point, Tom?
So things are looking up for the Byzantines.
Yeah, so they still think of themselves as Romans, don't they?
They do.
They still call themselves the Romaoi. They absolutely think we are Rome. We are and they have this massive city. They have tons of money. They're a very rich and sophisticated culture. And then one day in the year 860, they kind of look out of the window and these, as you said, these lads
in their ships
have turned up in their ships and. The patriarch, the archbishop of Constantinople, a man called Photius, has written this famous description of this. He says, the Rus are an obscure nation, a nation of no account, a nation ranked among slaves, unknown, but which has won a name from their expedition against us. So basically, the shocking thing for the people of Constantinople is that these utter nobodies, who they regard as so far beneath them, turn up and besiege their city.
And they keep doing this, don't they? And they seem to have very good intelligence because they invariably turn up when the imperial fleet is away.
Yeah, or the emperor's off campaigning against somebody else.
So, exactly. So the walls of Constantinople are a great wonder. They are impregnable, but there are obviously all kinds of churches and monasteries, you know, as in England, that are kind of lying exposed. And the Vikings have all kind of fun with them, don't they? They use monks as for archery practice. Yeah, and they nail hats on to the heads of priests and all kinds of badinage.
Very poor. So we have a question from, would you believe, Tom, we've got a question from Neville Chamberlain. Neville Chamberlain says, were there any attempts by the Vikings to take over Byzantium in the same way they tried with England and Ireland? Neville, of course, his reaction would no doubt be to appease
a faraway country,
which we know nothing. And my answer to that would be, it's completely implausible they would ever take over Constantinople.
There's one of them, isn't there, who nails his shield to the gates of Constantinople as a kind of gesture of contempt, because he obviously sees the walls as a kind of cheat.
Yeah.
But he knows that they're never going to break in.
I mean, it's like saying, you know, will Paraguay ever defeat the United States and conquer its territory? I mean, it's not a plausible matchup.
So Miklagard, the great city, it's Constantinople comes to kind of shimmer in the imaginings of all the Vikings so much that essentially the Asgard, the city of the gods, comes to be equated with it.
Yeah.
So that when they imagine what Odin's halls look like, they imagine it looking very like the Golden City of Caesar.
Don't they also, Tom, there are some people who think that when they talk about Asgard or they talk about Valhalla, that images of Hagia Sophia, the Church of the Holy Wisdom, incredible building, the biggest building in the Western world, I guess, at this point.
Which we'll come to.
Yeah.
It plays an important part in this story.
The gold, the mosaics, that creates a lot of the images of, because the images that we have of Valhalla, of Asgard, are all come later, don't they? They're all centuries after this.
And seem to kind of echo Constantinople. And I think, exactly. I think the other difference, so there's no prospect of them capturing Constantinople. But I think also what the Byzantine Empire can exert, which England or Ireland or even the Frankish Empire can't do, is to kind of generate this incredible cultural cringe. Because they, you know, every so often they're allowed, you know, they it's actually with Constantine VII, isn't it, who we mentioned in the previous episode, the emperor who describes this, the rapids that the Rus have to negotiate. And he kind of concludes a treaty that specifies, you know, where they, what they can trade, when they can trade, how they have to behave when they come. And they're kind of bringing in their walrus tusks and their narwhal tusks and their amber and their beeswax and all kinds of stuff. And they're also providing for what becomes very famous, a guard of what are called Varangians.
Yeah.
And the Varangian, a var is a vow. It's kind of
the oath takers, would that be?
The oath takers. And so they come to provide the emperor with his guard. And so the links, essentially, the Kievan Rus start to be absorbed into the kind of the cultural tractor beam of Byzantine culture.
Well, that's where I would say, Tom, I'm sure you, I don't think this is a controversial view at all. That's the point at which they stop being the Scandinavians who are known as the Rus, and they start becoming the ancestors of
Russia, Ukraine and Russia.
Because they're brought into the world of orthodoxy, of Byzantine church architecture, of all those kind of, they're beginning to kind of contract marriage alliances and trade deals and all this sort of stuff. And that brings them, you know, what do they care about what's going on in Norway? I mean,
yeah. And so by the mid 10th century, you get the first ruler of Kiev. I'm going to have a go at this, Sviatoslav. So he's the first ruler to have,
a Slavic name.
But before him, you've had various rulers who have more obviously Norse names. So we had Asgold and Deer were the guys who'd seized Kiev, but then that gets seized from them by a guy called Oleg.
That's right.
Who is the guardian of Rurik's son Igor? Yeah. Supposedly.
So Rurik is definitely Scandinavian, and Oleg is also definitely Scandinavian, because Oleg, which we always think of as a Russian name, is actually Helgi. I think.
Yeah.
Just like Olga is Helga. So Helgi, or as we call him, Oleg, he's the guardian. That's right. He's the guardian of Igor, and Oleg is a very impressive man. Generally, he takes over Kiev, he seizes it from Asgold and Deer, he leads another siege of Constantinople and gets a ton of money from sort of so this is your parallel with the West, actually. He gets basically Danegeld from the sort of Byzantine authorities in 904, but he has they have very good deaths, the grand princes of Kiev. So he has a very interesting death. He's been told, Oleg, that his favorite horse will be the cause of his death. So do you know what Oleg does, Tom?
Tell me.
He sends the horse away. He says, you know, I don't want to kill it, but because it's my favorite horse, but send it away and look after it, and I'll never have any dealings with it again. And after 4 years, in the year 914, he goes to visit the horse, and because he misses it so badly, it's so sad. He goes to visit the horse at the stables, and he's told by the stable hands, "Well, the horse is dead." And he says, ha, 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 "You know,
cheated fate.
Those astrologers were absolute muppets. You know, I've cheated death exactly." And he says, "Bring to show my contempt for these soothsayers. Bring me the skull of the horse." So they bring him the horse's skull, and he stamps on it. He's shouting, "The horse is dead, but I am still alive. I was supposed to receive my death from this skull." And he stamps on the horse's skull. And at that point, a snake crawls out from the horse's skull, bites him, and he dies.
There you go.
So the very act of defying the prophecy is what kills him.
But
yeah.
So he was guardian for Igor.
Yeah, so Igor then is then takes over.
Igor has an even better death.
He has a very unfortunate death, doesn't he?
So Igor is the guy who negotiates the treaty with Constantine the VII.
Because he's attacked them and been seen off with Greek fire, hasn't he?
Yes,
they first used Greek fire.
He does besiege Constantinople. He doesn't just attack, you know, with ships. He actually tries to take the city twice.
Yeah.
And he's a very, very kind of expansionist guy. So he's also, in his reign that they all go off and plunder all the kind of Muslim cities on the Caspian Sea.
Oh, yes, that's right. They go to Azerbaijan, don't they?
Go to Azerbaijan. So he's all over the place. I mean, he's very keen on kicking sand in people's face.
Yeah.
And one of the people that he kicks sand in the face of is a people called the Drevlians.
Yeah.
Or a Slavic people, and they capture him. They pull down two birch trees, and they tie him to the ends of these two trees, and then they let the two birch trees go. So he goes, grang, and he gets split in two, and that's the end of him.
Gosh.
However, this is not a sensible thing to have done.
It's now, probably not true,
coming
actually, Tom.
Dominic.
It's not true, that story.
Dominic, now center stage comes possibly the most interesting of all the rulers of Kiev, who is the wife of Igor and the mother of Sviatoslav, as he'll become, who will, you know, become this ruler. But she is ruling as regent, Olga, Helga.
Yeah, she's very. You've got a bit of a torn dress for Olga, I think.
I really have. She's the kind of the Æthelflæd of the East.
But she's much more.
She's very robust in her approach to the Drevlians.
Yeah. So they're Slavs, aren't they? They're the tree people, because Drevo is tree in Russian.
So presumably that's where the story of
the trees comes
the
from.
The birch trees.
But also, apparently, the chronicler was ripping off
Theseus.
Yeah, Diodorus or some Greek.
Yeah, it is. Yes. Yeah. But
so, like a lot of these stories, like basically everything in this podcast, possibly didn't happen.
So the Drevlians are obviously a bit nervous at whether Olga is going to be, you know, what's her reaction going to be. So they send an embassy to her, and she puts them on a ship and buries them alive.
Yeah. Well, they send the embassy saying, "Would you like to marry our leader, Prince Mal?" which is an extraordinary thing to do, the way they've treated her previous husband. Yeah, she buries them alive, doesn't she? Throws them
ship.
In a pit.
So a bit like we had Ibn Fadlan's account of the ship burial.
Yeah,
she seems to have done that, but they were alive. I think she kind of taunts them as the soil is being flooded.
But then that's
them.
Just the first of because she
yes she is
she has three revenges, doesn't she?
So another they then send another embassy. Because the first embassy hasn't returned.
Yeah.
I mean, so stupid.
What happened to those guys? Let's send another one.
So Olga burns them alive.
That's right. In the bathhouse. She says, go and have a wash.
Yeah.
And sets them
so obviously
fire.
Their standards of hygiene have improved by this point.
Yeah, clearly.
And then she goes and besieges the city where Igor was killed. And the story is that she besieges them for a year and finally she accepts that she's not going to capture it. So she negotiates a treaty with them and demands a kind of, you know, a very small tribute just as a kind of sign of their submission. And she demands 3 sparrows and Dominic, 3 pigeons. And you've been mocking the idea that we're going to be doing a podcast on pigeons, but this is a kind of interesting example of how pigeons have played an important role in world history.
I think you're underestimating the number of sparrows she asks for. I think she asks for 3 sparrows from each household.
Yeah, so each household have to give her a tribute.
Not from the city, generally.
No, yes. So each household has to give a tribute of three sparrows and 3 pigeons. And they do this, and she then sets them on fire. They dive bomb the city. It bursts into flames. She bursts in and kills everybody.
It's a great story. Do you think that happened, Dom? do you think that's a plausible...
well, there's a story that this happened in... during the war of Simon de Montfort against Henry III.
The whole sparrow carry on again.
There was a cock.
Right.
But they set fire to London.
I think, with
a burning cock.
I think, obviously, this is all from the Russian Primary Chronicle, isn't it? So, which I think is so clearly based on kind of previous models. But I think it's a good story. So let's not question it. Let's assume it definitely happened.
Okay. So Olga, robust in her approach to the murderers of her husband.
But also,
the
a
twist
saint.
Is
a yes. saint.
Yes. So she, and it's again a sign of the growing influence of Byzantine culture and civilization that she converts to Christianity and gets the baptismal name of Helena, which was the name of the mother of Constantine, who'd founded Constantinople. Her son doesn't convert, but she's allowed to serve as a patron of Christianity in Kiev.
So she goes to Constantinople, does she, to talk to Constantine the VII, the guy who wrote the manual, Porphyrogenitus. There's some talk of them marrying, but they don't marry, but she converts and she comes back with a load of vases, it said in the chronicle, which is nice.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because, and this is one of those things that kind of makes a mockery of our attempts to fix labels on these people. Because she is, as you say, a Christian, but her son, Sviatoslav, he is still
a rampaging pagan.
A pagan. She has a Scandinavian name, Helga. He has a Slavic name. But there's no sense that this is a kind of contradiction or that this is some problem that needs to be resolved. It's just, you know, the sort of the flux and mess of how things are.
Yep. And he, like his dad, is a great conqueror. So he knocks out the Khazars.
Well, he's one of the first. He's the first of these people we have a physical description of, a genuine physical description made by, who is it? By one of the Byzantines, Leo the Deacon. He says he's a moderate height. He's got a snub nose. He's got a sort of bushy moustache and a shaved head. But a lock of hair that hangs down on one side.
That's right. Yes, kind of hanging down his side, isn't it?
He had an rather angry and savage appearance. You're telling me. he's got a gold earring with 2 pearls and a red gemstone. His clothing was white, no different from that of his companions, except in cleanliness. So he's well turned out, despite his savage appearance. And yeah, sorry, Tom, I interrupted you. He wipes the floor with the Khazars, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. And is he the father of, Vladimir is Russian, Volodymyr, I gather, if you're Ukrainian.
He is, right? Yeah. But again, a name that people think possibly has sort of Norse Germanic roots, and it could have been Valdemar, some kind of Norse name. But yeah, he attacks the Bulgars, he attacks the Khazars. I mean, you're saying that Igor was expansionist. Sviatoslav is very expansionist.
Vladimir.
He fights absolutely.
Vladimir.
No, Sviatoslav.
Oh, yes, yes.
He's very expansionist, but he has an interesting death too, Tom. None of them die safely quietly in their bed. You know what happens to him?
Tell me.
He has gone and attacked Constantinople again.
As you do.
I mean, presumably, I think they're attacking Constantinople to get better trade. They're like Lord Frost, who's obviously a listener to the show and presumably listening to the show an awful lot now that he's left his...
got more time.
Brexit. I'm surprised disappointed he hasn't been sending in more of those excellent Danish-themed questions. They're presumably doing it to get tribute and to get, you know, money and better trade negotiations and stuff. But he's gone and attacked Constantinople. It didn't really work out. He comes back and he ends up being ambushed at the rapids on the River Dnieper by our old friends, the Pechenegs. And do you know what they do to him?
No, tell me.
They cut his head off. They plate it with gold, and they use it as a drinking vessel.
Oh, that's so predictable.
It's like that's only medieval Balkan.
They're always doing
formulaic
that.
Behavior.
I think tying to a tree and ripping them in half is much more creative.
Okay, fair enough.
Even if it didn't happen.
Yeah, even if it didn't happen. So anyway, he has multiple sons. They all fight each other, and the winner is
Volodymyr.
Well, it's interesting actually, Tom, because almost every book on this calls him Vladimir, which is Russian.
But I've been told off by Ukrainians for calling him Vladimir.
Agreed. So if you look at Sergei Plokhy's book on the history of Ukraine, he calls him Volodymyr. Yeah. And it's a bit like we've talked about Kiev, and in our minds, no doubt, because we're born in the 70s, that word is spelt K-I-E-V, not K-Y-I-V. So at this point, we're getting more and more into the kind of territory where everything is contested between Russian and Ukrainian. Yeah.
But what isn't contested is the absolute key significance of his reign, because it's in his reign that the Ukrainians, the Rus, become Christian.
You call them Ukrainians?
The Rus. Okay,
please direct all your complaints to Tom Holland, not to me. Cable Loft,
the Rus, the Russians, the Ukrainians, whatever.
So, Tom, tell us, because his conversion to Christianity is a great tale in itself, isn't it?
Well, we've been talking about how so much of this material has a kind of folkloric dimension to it.
Yeah.
And in the previous episode, we talked about the Khazars, about how, they can't decide whether to become Christian or Jewish or Muslim. And there's a very similar story told about Vladimir. He's in a world surrounded by worshippers of a single god. Which should he convert to?
Yeah.
And so he sends emissaries to the Muslim world, the caliphate, and they report back and say, well, you'd have to give up drink. So that's an absolute no-no. And he sends them to the lands of the Franks, and they report back and say, yeah, it's all right, but cathedrals aren't great. And then he sends them to Constantinople, and they go to Hagia Sophia, the great cathedral, and they come back and they report in awed terms, we knew not whether we were in heaven or on earth, for on earth there is no such splendor or such beauty. We only know that God dwells there among men. We cannot forget that beauty. And so this persuades Vladimir that he should go with Orthodox Christianity, the Christianity of Constantinople. Now, that story is obviously
completely true.
Not true.
Oh, Tom, don't say that. Because those are the most famous foundational lines.
I know.
At the center of kind of Russian, Belarusian.
But there are two obvious
Ukrainian
reasons why they're not true.
Go on.
The first is that they're very familiar with Constantinople.
Yeah, because
they don't need to send emissaries out to report back on what Hagia Sophia is like. They've been there. They know that. And the other is that this is very geopolitically determined.
They're choosing a superpower, right?
They're choosing a superpower.
But Tom, I'm gutted that you missed out that they also went to visit the Bulgars on the Volga. And do you know what they said when they came back from the Volga? When we journeyed among the Bulgars, we beheld how they worship in their temple called a mosque while they stand ungirt. The Bulgar bows, sits down, looks hither and thither like one possessed. And there is no happiness among them, but instead only sorrow and a dreadful stench.
That's not...
You wouldn't choose that religion, would you?
No, you wouldn't. You wouldn't go for that one.
Not the stench. Apologies to any... Bulgarians and Bulgars know.
Bulgarian Muslims. Yeah. But you get. The great incense in Hagia Sophia.
No stench there.
Very beautiful.
So he's obviously choosing it as power politics, isn't he?
And the Byzantines are as well, because they offer Vladimir something that no barbarian leader has ever been offered before by Byzantine emperor. And that is marriage into the imperial family in the form of the emperor's, Basil II's sister, Anna.
Yeah, she's not happy, is she? She's not happy at all. She apparently is very cross about it. And there's some sort of breakdown in negotiations because he has to actually attack the Crimea in order to...
Well, that's where it all happens, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, so the Crimea, which is obviously very, it's in the crosshairs of current politics... the Crimea matters to both Ukrainians and Russians today because it's where Vladimir is baptized and then marries Anna.
Yeah. And he has a weird thing where he has at the baptism, he has all the old idols cast down, and there's an idol of somebody called Perun, who was made of wood and had a golden moustache. And he's tied to a horse's tail and dragged down a hill. And then Volodymyr gets 12 men to beat him with cudgels as a sort of sign, you know, I'm rejecting the old gods and embracing a new one. But it's also, I mean, obviously it's a two-way process, isn't it? Because, as you said, the Varangian guard, it's not Volodymyr who sends the Varangian, the big contingent that become the Varangian guard to Constantinople?
Because that's part of the treaty with Basil.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that Basil will get. You would assume, wouldn't you, that they must have had Varangian mercenaries in their army before they had the official guard, that Harald Hardrada ends up being the commander.
So Harald Hardrada is I mean, in a way, he's the kind of the end of this story, the end point of this story, isn't he?
He is. Yeah.
We'll take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk Harald Hardrada and really the end of the Viking Age.
Okay. Welcome back to The Rest Is History. We are reaching the end of the Viking Age, which we've told entirely through a focus on the Vikings in the East. And the last and most famous Viking character, I think, certainly in England, to have been eastward bound is Harald Hardrada, who we know as the man who lost the Battle of Stamford Bridge, but had the most extraordinary life and career before that, didn't he, Tom?
He really did. And we've been focusing on the first part of this episode on the princes of Kiev, this kind of emergent Rus state. But all along, up in Scandinavia, you've still got kind of Viking adventurers who are treating these eastern lands as places that you can kind of retreat to if you need to.
Yeah. Also places to make money, basically, and bring back tons of silver.
So Harald Sigurdsson, he's the brother of Olaf Sigurdsson, Olaf the Stout, who will become Saint Olaf, the patron saint of Norway. And he's briefly been king. He messes up. He gets killed and supposedly martyred.
The battle called Stiklestad, which Harald is at, because Harald is a teenager, I think, at that battle, isn't he? He's about 15 or so.
Yeah.
And he has to go into exile. And
he goes to Novgorod.
And this is, Tom, actually, for those people who have found this all a bit sci-fi, because it's lots of weird names and stuff, their big antagonist is Knut, famous for attempting to turn back waves. Again, something that didn't happen.
Friend of the show.
An early faller in the Rest Is History World Cup of
Kings.
Kings, but I think a very impressive king. I mean, a very formidable king, indeed. So king of a North Sea empire. He's basically taken over England after the end of Ethelred the Unready. He's married to Emma from Normandy. And he's
so it all
great,
connects.
He's everything connects. So he's the great antagonist that basically Harald Hardrada, the young Harald Hardrada, is terrified of Canute. He flees and he ends up.
It is a Western, isn't it? Or a mafia story or a science fiction story. I mean, you can see how the patterns of these stories, why it's such a kind of great setting for an epic.
It is, absolutely.
He's been run out of town by the local cattle rustler.
Yeah, but as a boy, basically, as a teenager, he's got, such a stuff of a kind of children's story. He goes off down the river, like so many people have for, what is it now, 250 years.
Yeah.
And he ends up in Kiev, where the successor to Volodymyr, I think it is, Yaroslav the Wise,
also known as the Lame,
is now he could be wise and lame, couldn't you? I mean,
yeah, well, he's lame to begin with, and then he's so wise that he gets promoted.
Right, that's good. So he's upwardly mobile in that sense.
If he'd not, beaten off his brother,
he's upwardly mobile, but not kind of mobile.
They'd had a kind of amazing war with his brother, fratricidal war, where they, they're fighting across ice-covered rivers and amazing. The first great northern war.
That's very good. So, but Harald Hardrada wasn't in that war, was he?
No. So by this point, Yaroslav is the kind of the wise king.
And Hardrada, who's not yet Hardrada, he's just Harald Sigurdsson.
The young Harald.
So he pitches up and he becomes basically an enforcer for Yaroslav, doesn't he? He serves in his guard or whatever, and why does he end up going further down towards Constantinople, Tom?
Well, I think he is looking to get back to Norway.
Yeah,
that's the ultimate aim. And you know, Kiev's all very well, but the place where you're really going to make money is Constantinople.
Yeah,
so he's going down there with the aim of
he needs cash.
Because when he goes down there, he makes a tremendous success of it, and the epic Snorri Sturluson epic telling his adventures. He fights with dragons. He marries princesses. He goes to the Holy Land. He conquers Sicily. He
genuinely does some of these things, doesn't he?
He really does.
He goes to Sicily with the Byzantine. I'm reading something here that says he's a marine. He's a marine in the Byzantine fleet with a man called Georgios Maniarchis. Do you know him? Is he a eunuch? No, he's the brother of a eunuch, isn't he? Or something like that.
Of course. Anyway,
everyone is the brother of a eunuch. Harold plays a great trick on Maniarchis when they're in Sicily. Do you know about this trick?
Remind me.
It's an excellent trick. So they're discussing who's going to get the best campsite for them and their part of the army. And they decide to draw lots. And Maniarchis marks his lot with a sort of a mark on it, his thing, whatever they're using. And Harold says, well, can I have a look at your lot so that I can mark mine in a different way? And Maniarchis says, oh, yeah, of course. So they then put the both in a bag. And another man takes the lot out. And Harold takes it and he throws it in the sea. And he says, that was my lot. I've won. You know, I get the best place for the
that was good fooling.
I haven't finished the story. He says, that was my, and Maniarchis says, how do I know that was yours? I mean, there's no way I can know that was yours. And Harold says, well, have a look in the bag. And Maniarchis looks in the bag and he takes out the lot and it's got his mark on it. He says, oh, it must have been yours. But of course, Harold made the same mark on his lot as was on Maniarchis. The lesson of that story is that Maniarchis is an absolute idiot.
I think it's a lesson that Harold's an absolute japester.
Right.
Well, anyway, great one for the prank.
Anyway, I mean, you're portraying him as a sort of Les Dawson figure, but actually...
Les Dawson?
And he's a prankster, isn't he? I mean, I don't know. He's a joker.
No, he's a great barrel.
Yeah, he's not a mother-in-law joke man.
No. So, no, he slapped you on the back.
But he...
So your teeth go flying out.
But he then gets drawn into... He goes back to... He goes all these campaigns, goes to the Holy Land, he goes to Bulgaria, all sorts of campaigns. He's very, very highly rated by the Byzantines. They make him Spatharo Candidatus. I'm very glad I read that out correctly. He's a Spatharo Candidatus, which is a very high rank for a foreigner. And he's been given a pay rise, and he's the commander of the palace guard, and all this, that, and the other. And then he gets drawn into the power politics. Are you familiar with all these Michaels?
It's very, yes. I mean, it's almost impossible not to get drawn into it, isn't it? When you reach a certain level.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. So Michael IV is the emperor, I think. Well, he's married to the Empress Zoe, and they have all kinds of feuding. And at some point, basically, Harold is told by Zoe, get the guy who's been kicked out as emperor and gouge his eyes out, please. Mm-hmm. And he does. Mm. He can't trust his men to do it, so he gouges them out. Personally.
I mean, the sense you get of Harold is that he's very much the kind of guy who, you know, guy needs to have his eyes gouged out. He's going to do it.
Yeah, he's
hands on.
And when an emperor dies, the tradition is that the Varangians get to strip the imperial palace of all its gold. So Harold does that. And Harold actually is there for so long, he gets to do that three times.
So he's, by the time he heads back, he's so rich.
He's incredibly rich. The Empress Zoe, who's in her 60s, quite fancies marrying him.
Yeah.
But she has a bad habit of murdering her husbands and gouging their eyes out.
Yeah.
So Harold is not keen on that.
And at some point he's locked up in a dungeon with a dragon, I think.
Yeah, he is. He escapes. Yeah. He escapes from Constantinople. I mean, as with so much of this, you know, how much of this is true? A little bit, I think, with him, because we've got Byzantine sources. The stuff in the sagas, obviously, clearly quite, you know, the same people who worked on the sagas worked on the TV series Vikings, basically.
The two things that are clearly true is that he comes back from Constantinople with a formidable fighting record.
Yeah.
You know, he is the hard rider, the hard ruler. And also that he's unbelievably rich.
Yeah. And I'm conscious that we've told his story in a quite shambolic way.
Yeah,
but I think he's not the subject of this podcast. He's just an incidental character. But
he's the last of the Vikings, isn't he? So we can talk, he's got this money basically so that he can then get together a large army and go and get back the throne of Norway, which is what he does.
Which is basically in the long run, there's a lot of carry on with his brother, is it Magnus, his half brother? They split the kingdom and Magnus dies and Harald becomes a very, very fierce and ruthless king of Norway. Hence the name Hardrada, hard ruler. I mean, the only thing about that is, you know, is that a career peak? Because would you rather be the captain of the guard in Constantinople or the king of Norway?
I'd rather be king of Norway.
Would you?
Yeah. Because in Constantinople, you're surrounded by predatory empresses and
eunuchs
and, yeah,
but
dragons.
I think in Constantinople, the weather is better. The food's a hell of a lot better. There's more money. Everything is nicer.
No, but you're not. The whole thing is to have your own, own
right.
land.
Yeah, I suppose it is. You're right.
You have a slave's attitude to life. Whereas if you're,
who are you ventriloquizing there?
Harald Hardrada.
Okay.
I have the spirit of a Viking.
Right. I think Harald, you should.
You have the spirit of a eunuch.
Thanks. I'll remember that. I think Harald Hardrada.
Well, truth hurts.
I think Harald.
Absolutely betrayed yourself.
Well, let's see what happens to Harald Hardrada, Tom.
Well, he dies, but it's, hero's death. So that's the perfect thing, isn't it? That Harald Hardrada dies 1066, the year that basically, traditionally it's the kind of the quietus of the Viking age, and he is a perfect figure to bring it to an end, because he's a guy who dies in England like so many Viking adventurers before him.
Yeah,
but he's made his name, he's made his money in the East.
Yeah, and also because his career kind of sums up all the in some ways he's quite a sort of out of time figure, isn't he? I mean, these places are becoming kingdoms.
Yeah.
You know, they are becoming more settled, slightly more ordered, I suppose. They are Christian now rather than pagan.
And of course, with 1066, the Anglo-Saxon nobility go off and replace the Scandinavians as the Varangians.
They do. So the irony is that actually people who could have conceivably fought on opposite sides at the Battle of Stamford Bridge could well end up serving 5 years later.
But I think
the same army for the Emperor Constantinople.
I mean, I think that's that part of the fascination of this whole subject of the Vikings in the East is that sense of, Vikings and Romans.
Yeah.
It's kind of people out of time running up with one another.
Absolutely.
Or Vikings, in the Caspian Sea. It does have that kind of slight element of fantasy about it.
Well, that's why, for example, Michael Crichton wrote a book called The Death Eaters or something like that. I can't remember. Something, The Eaters of Light or The Eaters of something like that, about with Ibn Fadlan as a character. And that was later adapted for the cinema as The 13th Warrior, I think. And Rosemary Sutcliffe has written about it. And Henry Treece,
yeah, The Road to Micklegard.
Exactly. It's a permanent, it's exactly as you say, it's got a slight science fiction quality to it in that it's Arabs, Romans, Vikings, all kind of...
All mixed up.
All mixed up, exactly. And I think that's one way, even now when we mentioned to people we could do this as a subject, you could see that people are kind of excited about it because it's the ultimate exotic adventure story, I think.
Yeah, and as we said right at the beginning of the first episode, which seems a very long time ago, it's also very, very politically sensitive.
And Tom, obviously there is no answer to that Russian-Ukrainian question with this. I mean, it obviously... it's the foundational moment of both countries' history books. There are statues of these characters in Ukraine and in Russia, understandably.
There's a statue of Vladimir in London.
Is there?
Yeah.
Why?
Just down from Notting Hill.
Is it outside a church or something?
It must be something to do with that, yeah.
You can completely understand why they both lay claim. And obviously, I'm not going to, be mad to sort of pick sides in this sort of... In the sort of political debate, we're not a political podcast, but they both clearly do that. They do have different histories, Russia and Ukraine, but they come from the same place. I think it's fair to say.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, right, we're just whittering now.
Great stuff. This has been a podcast devoted to people going to the sea, taking to the water, trading, stabbing each other in the back. And our next episode, by coincidence, is going to be on smuggling.
Perfect link, Tom. Well done.
So we will see you then.
Yeah, we'll see you for smugglers next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.